This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. And after a weekend of silent promotions and relegations with English football's key stakeholders all united in a social media blackout, the divisional players of the season at this year's EFL Awards all had a pretty good weekend. In the Sky Bet Championship, Emi Buendia and his Norwich City teammates sealed the title with the most points amassed in a single campaign in the club's history and still a game to go. In Sky Bet League One, oh, what drama, as Johnson Clark-Harris scored his 30th and then in the 6th minute of added on time, 31st goal of the season to wrap up the second automatic promotion place for Peterborough United. And in Sky Bet League 2, a brace for Paul Mullen to also take him to 31, so Cambridge United score 4 on the road for the 5th time this season. But for the 2nd week in a row, promotion must wait for them. It's the final weekend of the regular season. It's the official EFL podcast. Okay, quiet in the cheap seats, because talking of this year's EFL Awards, this week we are in the presence of Football League royalty. It's always a sad day when a footballer retires, let alone one who has graced EFL pitches for approaching a quarter of a century. I might be over-egging that slightly, but that's what's going to happen after the final round of Sky Bet League One fixtures this coming weekend, when one of Doncaster Rovers' all-time greats, who at last week's awards was given the Sir Tom Finney Lifetime Achievement Award, heads off into the sunset. We can bow, we can curtsy, we can doff our caps as we welcome James Coppinger. Who is feeling what, mate? We're catching you just a few days before your final hurrah. What are you feeling about things now? What's going through your head?
I'm actually excited about what's next. You know, I've had quite a bit of time to almost count down the games, although they've come thick and fast. But I'm genuinely excited about what's going to happen next on my journey. You know, I'm more than prepared, but yeah, a little bit apprehensive about sort of the final day.
And this week in particular, a little bit of you must be, I mean, weird as well, because obviously not so many people are around and social distancing protocols and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, who's going to take over your locker at the training ground? And what are you going to do? What are you going to do with all those dodgy old jock straps you've been hanging on to, because that was the one you wore when you got promotion at Wembley? Have you been having to have a bit of a clear up around the training ground and stuff?
I wish I had a locker. No, I think that sort of sentimental element has been really difficult this season, you know, with COVID, with all the restrictions. You know, right at the beginning, we were training in 3s, 4s, then 5s. No showers, no food, couldn't congregate inside. No fans, you know, my dad, my family, my friends haven't been able to come and watch me. And it's been so tough this season. You know, when I signed my contract in July, I was adamant that fans would be back in January, and everybody else felt the same way. It hasn't been the case. And, you know, people talking for me to play for another year. And I've thought about it, and it's been on the back of my mind. You know, I've contributed, sort of come into the team in the last 20 games. But you know what? The timing's perfect. And to get the Sir Tom Finney Award almost is the icing on the cake for me, and almost signifies the end, if you like.
When, James, did you definitively decide that you weren't going to extend for one more year? Because I came to see you, what, 6-7 weeks ago to do a piece for BBC One's Football Focus. And I know in the run-up to that, and I will share it with listeners, that I was a little bit, well, don't change your mind once we filmed it before we get a chance to transmit it and things. So we were, but I mean, you were genuinely moved by the actions of fans and their enthusiasm for you to stay for one more season, for definite.
And I still am, you know, like, The amount of people that have reached out to me that want me to play for another year. And, you know, if everything was perfect, then I would, but it doesn't always end like that. And that isn't always the case. It's not just me wanting to play for another year. It's the club wanting to offer me a new contract, and all the other things that go with that. You know, football at 40 isn't just about turning up on a Saturday. There's a lot that goes into that every single day. I've got a wife, 3 kids, travel up and down from the northeast every single day. And it takes a lot out of you mentally and physically. And, you know, from the ages of probably 30 to 40, I've put a lot into it. And probably the reason why people want to see me play for another year is because of the standards that I've set for myself and my teammates. But that doesn't come easy. And it's not something that I think I'd be able to maintain for another year, if I'm being honest.
Are you quite exhausted with it? You're talking about just the sort of general structure that comes around being a professional footballer, just being in the right place at the right time, being prepared, having watched whatever clips you need to, having got yourself in the right sort of place mentally before a game, let alone doing all the training.
Yeah, and it's, you know, as much as I formed a strategy about every time I drive out the training ground, I sort of leave my football at the training ground and then become James Coppinger, the husband, the dad, you know, the friend, the coach of two kids' teams. Like, it is, you're constantly thinking about the next game, recovering, what to eat, what not to eat, how to rest. And as you get older, these things become sort of more heightened and you have to do it even more. So for me, you know, when I come to the end of the season, like, I'm wiped out. So every season I have probably 2-3 days and I'm totally sort of wiped out with the amount of, I wouldn't say pressure, but the amount of sort of energy that I've wasted and put into the season.
It's quite interesting to hear it in that context, because there'll be a lot of people, you know what the accusation is, footballers, they just turn up for 90 minutes once a week and things, but the reality behind the scenes and everything that goes on is very different. So here's the question, and you put your head in your hands when I accused you of nearly playing for a quarter of a century. So 17 seasons with Doncaster Rovers, 10 managers, it's worked out the fee that they paid for you, it's probably cost them 50 quid a game. First player in their history to play 600 league games, and this season you also completed your 800th career game. So it does beg the question, at a time in the game when a lot of people seemed as though the trend was going to be to retire, even late 20s, very early 30s, how you've managed to squeeze another decade out of that mind and those legs.
And it is that, you know, for me, it is my mind. I see so many players retire through, yeah, the mental side of it. They just can't cope with it, whether it's players that have played at a higher level coming down the pyramid and struggle financially to justify it, the love for the game, the teams they're going to, the stadiums they're turning up to. But for me, football has never been about that. Football is about playing football, winning, and almost that love for competing. And, you know, I turn up every day and I want to win. I turn up every week and I want to win. And it's something that I'm trying to get across to my 14-year-olds at the minute. You know, up until 14, football is about enjoying it. And then you have to sort of make a decision. You know, football is about winning. Nobody enjoys losing. And, you know, that's something that I've taken I played Sunday League all the way up to 16. I wasn't in an academy. Every time I played a football match, it meant something to me. And, you know, from 30 to 40, it was no different. If not, it was more. It meant more to me because I knew that the end was coming closer and closer and closer. So I had to constantly raise my game, raise my standards, raise the bar and keep going and going and going. I think I said to you, sort of 35, 36, 37, 38, you know, player of the seasons, team of the seasons, statistically probably my best returns, because I had to do that. You know, I was under pressure to constantly deliver, and if you don't, you get that thrown at you. You know, his legs are gone, he's too old. So I think genuinely my love for the game and my mentality has got me between 30 and 40 comfortably.
So I want to know, when you first walked into the club in the summer of 2004, what was going through your head? How did you think it might play out?
I was just happy to be back up north. I had a really difficult spell at Exeter, got relegated out of the Football League, and then I played a season in the Conference, which I found really tough. But I had a great mentor and manager in Eamon Dolan, who sadly passed away recently. He was probably the biggest reason I went back down there, refused to go back to pre-season. So we missed out on the last day of the season to get into the playoffs. And then I was just so happy to come back up north, met with the Doncaster manager, Dave Penny, at the time. And I was almost like starting my career again. Obviously went from Sunday League to Premier League to non-league within 5 years. And then it's like, right, start taking this seriously now. And then I think I've spoke to you about meeting Terry Gormley a year at Doncaster. Then I met Terry and everything sort of just changed for me.
Yeah, just to explain to the listeners to the Official EFL podcast who Terry Gormley is. And also, if you think you're just going to gloss over the fact that you were refusing to go to pre-season training, you better just explain that too, that you were on the verge of quitting the game altogether at Exeter at the end of that first season when you'd played in the National League for a season.
Yeah, so I went through no academy system. I went from Sunday League, playing at 16 with my friends. And then I signed for Newcastle for 1.8 million at 17 after 6 months as a YTS at Darlington. Made my Premier League debut at 19. And then I got relegated out of the Football League at 20. So for me, I had a real sort of insight into the ups and downs of what it was about. And I was ready to quit football. I spoke to my girlfriend, my mum, my dad, and just said, look, I've had enough. This isn't for me. And yeah, I was on the golf course with a friend and got a phone call from Eamon saying, look, I want you, a huge part of what I want to do next season. He just got the job. I'll give you Mondays off. It was 350 miles away from my house. You can go back home and then, you know, I'll work with you all season and we'll get through this. So, and I went back there. I learned so much from him. He almost became that support network that I didn't have the season before. And yeah, it was just almost for me looking back the time where, you know, if I hadn't have got through that, it wouldn't have made me stronger. And that's what I say to players now, you know, relegations, setbacks, disappointments, you have to get through the other side to make you a better person and a better player.
It's a great insight. So that's Eamon Dolan. That's the Exeter side. The second part of the question, and you know I do like a long question, and I'm elongating this one just for effect and making this one as long as I can possibly make it, just in order to underline the fact that I do like a very long question, which can often take up 30 to 45 seconds because of the way in which I interject other words and things. Terry Gormley was the other part of the original question before I went off on this particular question, which has got to at least 50 seconds now.
It's given me a bit of time to think about the answer. Terry was almost a psychologist, behaviourist, just a genuine person who wanted to make a difference. And I've been working with him for 17 years now, a mentor, whatever you want to call him. I went to meet him at Bellevue, at the stadium, not quite knowing what I was getting into, not quite knowing what I was going for, but understanding that, you know, it could potentially help me. So I went, the first session I went with Terry transformed my life completely. Started to understand I was able to analyse what had gone wrong in the past. I started to learn about being accountable for my actions. And I genuinely worked out that I was letting other people control what I did, you know, both on and off the pitch. I had things that had happened to me. My granddad passed away at 21 through cancer. Within 8 months, he passed away. He was my hero, somebody who supported me all the way through my journey. My mum and dad divorced at 17, never saw that coming at all. Never dealt with that. So we sort of worked out there was a few different things that I needed to get over. And then, you know, I started to work on personal development, and I have done ever since. And, you know, both on and off the pitch, my life has been transformed over the last 17 years. And it's down to that. It's down to changing my thinking, my mindset. And yeah, it's something that I work with players now.
What an inspirational story, mate. And I guess the message to anybody that's struggling after what's been a tough year for many, many people with the whole pandemic is that sometimes it can come down to taking one little step, having the faith and pushing yourself out of your comfort zone to walk in that room with a Terry Gormley who can take your life in a different direction.
100%. And I think what a lot of players and a lot of people do is they keep doing the same things and thinking in the same way and expect different results. And that is never, ever going to happen. And I was one of them people. I was constantly wishing and hoping things would change for me, but doing the same things and thinking in the same way. So what I started to do was think differently, act differently. And my results just went from strength to strength, you know. Just started playing games. I think I've played 42 games every season for the last 17 seasons, averaged. Started being consistent and off the pitch, you know, married, three kids. I did so many, or have done so many different things that I would never have envisaged back then. Captained my club to promotion, played at Wembley, played at Millennium Stadium. You know, there's so many things that I've achieved because of the way I started to think and because I believed it was possible. And it's all down to, I'd like to say it's all down to Terry, but it's all down to me. And I don't mean that in a selfish way, but I made a conscious decision to make that change and start something new, something fresh. And yeah, I'm really proud of what I've achieved.
It's so inspiring to hear this story. I suppose the other part of your own personal journey is when you have been involved in the sort of end to a season like you did in 2013, then you start to believe in the impossible, don't you? I'm assuming you would pick that as the moment from your career, the game at Griffin Park, that goal.
Without a doubt, I think there's been some real special moments that I've had personally and collectively at Doncaster. The hat-trick I scored in the semi-final, a personal moment for me, leading to Wembley, obviously winning at Wembley against Leeds. But that moment, you know, on the final day of the season, in the final minute of the season, to win the league, to score the goal to win the league for your club, the club that you've spent over 10 years at the time, was, again, you couldn't write it, but also something that I envisaged, you know, something that I'd almost gone over in my head. I know I've spoke to you about the free kick that I've recently scored, and I'm a huge believer in the law of attraction and visualization, and this was no different. So I'd almost seen that happen, not the actual goal, but me scoring. I'd roomed with Dean Furman that night and spoke to him about it, that somebody could be a hero, somebody could, you know, write their name in folklore, and I wanted to be that person. So when that happened, it was unbelievable. You know, my daughter's 7 now, and since she was about 3 years old, every night she goes to bed, she says that to me, anything is possible, even the impossible, every single night. And she has like a little like flag on her wall. And it's habit now, you know, every single night she can't go to bed without saying that to me. And it, you know, it warms my heart every time I hear it, and you know, it's inspiring, you know, to even be saying that at 7 years old.
Do you just want to describe it for official EFL podcast listeners? Just that last minute of the game at Griffin Park, where both teams, Brentford and Doncaster, could have gone up. And could have gone up within the space of about 45 seconds either way. Go on, in your own words. It's breathtaking.
Yeah, I think for us, we needed a draw, so it was 0-0. Jamie McCombs give a penalty away right in the last minute, literally the last minute of the game. Michael Oliver was the referee. And they started sort of arguing over who was going to take the penalty, Marcel Trotter. And their captain, O'Connor. O'Connor was the penalty taker, and Trotter, for whatever reason, fancied taking it. And I just stood in disbelief. You know, another 2 weeks, 3 weeks in the playoffs, travelling up and down in a sort of the Kia Sedona that we'd we'd all drove up and down in, car shared. And you're just thinking, well, I was thinking the worst.
Brentford have gone absolutely bananas. What a nervous moment this is for Trotter. He steps up, he's hit the bar. He's hit the crossbar and he's missed it.
It's hit the bar. You don't have time to think anything. Paul Quinn clears it and I just turn around and see nobody back. And Billy Painter just stood on the sideline. He runs the full length of the pitch and I run alongside him. He squares it and I tap it in. And
you put it into the empty net. And Doncaster have won promotion to the Championship. The flares go off in the away end. What drama. Penalty missed at one end. Doncaster go to the other. Coppinger has won it.
You know, it gives me goosebumps there. I throw my shirt in the crowd, jump into the crowd, and you know, I've got an unbelievable picture of like the shot from behind the goal, and it looks back and there's probably five or six Brentford players on their knees in the box, and you know, the flares went off in the away end, and that was it. That was the last kick of the game. I didn't even have a chance to get back on the pitch. I think I put Kyle Bennett's shirt on and We're promoted, but at that time we didn't realise we were champions. And then we obviously came through that Bournemouth had drew with Tranmere and that we were champions of League One. And what an unbelievable finish to the season.
I mean, you've described it beautifully, including the car as well. Just to clarify that, there was a car share involved, and in the middle of the pitch, James, the first thing that came in his head as Brentford went to take the penalty was, oh my Lord, I'm going to be stuck in the car with that sweaty lot for another 3 weeks as we try and get through the playoffs. And the whole span from Trotter hitting the penalty at one end to you putting in at the other end, we reckon was just over 40 seconds. Just the most breathtaking drama imaginably, and brilliantly told, if I may say so. And just to add to this, I don't know if I've ever shared this with you. I don't know if I did when I saw you a few weeks ago, but I'm standing in the tunnel afterwards and Uwe Rosler, the Brentford manager, is tearing Kevin O'Connor a strip off. Why didn't you take the ball from him? Why didn't you? You were our penalty taker. And at that moment, the drugs testers pounced and dragged two of your lads and two of the Brentford lads and put them in the same room until they could produce a sample. Two are high as kites. They're on the ceiling. They've just won the title. And the other two have missed out with the opportunity to be promoted. And they all had to stay in the same room, drinking water until they could produce a sample. Let's just be discreet in that. Mate, it's brilliant to have you with us. You've kindly agreed to help us sort of have a very quick whistle stop as to where we are as we go into the final round of fixtures. And you're quite uniquely positioned because obviously you have been involved in three promotions, three relegations. Let's start in the Skybet Championship, where we send congratulations to Norwich, who are the champions. Watford also promoted automatically. Brentford, Swansea, Bournemouth and Barnsley will contest the playoffs. But still a lot of interest this coming weekend in the three relegation places which are yet to be signed and sealed. Your Skybet Championship table, and everybody's played 45 games. Bottom, Wickham, minus 33 goal difference on 40 points. Sheffield Wednesday on 40 points, minus 21 goal difference. Then come Rotherham on 41 points, minus 16 goal difference. And the other team that could still go down are Derby County, 43 points, minus 22. Your key fixtures that matter, Wickham travel to Middlesbrough needing absolute miracles, but heroics to still be in contention last game of the season. Rotherham travel to Cardiff, and would you believe it, it is Derby County against Sheffield Wednesday. I mean, Derby-wise, do you think the whole talk about takeover and, you know, Sheikh Mansour of Man City's cousin buying the club, then it took forever and didn't materialise, then somebody else, do you think that has had an effect on that group of players, James?
I think it will have. I think probably unconsciously without them knowing it. You know, I always talk about having a clear direction of where you're going, both on and off the pitch as a player. That does filter into the dressing room. Also momentum, you know, as much as you can have winning momentum, it's the same with losing. You know, I've been at both ends, like you said, and when you can't win a game, it's really, really tough. And it's you're looking for everything. You're looking for, as a manager, I've played with managers that change things, that keep things the same, and it's just so hard to find that formula. So obviously all the teams fighting for that relegation are looking for a one-off performance to save them. I mean, we got relegated on goal difference last day of the season against Leicester. Leicester was champions of the Championship going into the Premier League. We needed a draw, and Birmingham, obviously Cadiz scored that goal in the last minute that relegated us on goal difference. For me, you have to focus on your performance alone. You can't worry about what other people are doing, and that's what we did that season. We beat Leeds at Elland Road. I think we were 9 points safe with six games left, and we took our eye off the ball, thought we were safe, and ended up getting relegated.
In the case of Wickham and Rotherham, does every club have a level? Maybe those two are commensurate with the club that you're about to play for the last time for. And fans just need to accept that, you know, sometimes Doncaster could be at the top end of League One and other times they are going to be at the bottom end of the Championship. And does the same apply to Wickham and Rotherham? I mean, it's Herculean that those two are still in contention with a game to go, isn't it? Albeit Wickham hanging by a thread.
I agree completely, and that's where we were 4 or 5 seasons in the Championship. I think the best place we finished was 12th or 13th the first season we were in there. And then, yeah, you're constantly fighting against relegation. And that's why I think a lot of people tipped Rotherham to stay up, because they've been in and around it and they had the experience of sort of scrapping at that end, whereas Derby, Sheffield Wednesday haven't had that over the last few seasons.
And with regard to Sheffield Wednesday, I mean, 6 points deducted was 12, but reduced to 6. I mean, that in itself is not insurmountable from players' points of view, is it? But then when you have a regime where there have been 5 different managers, if you include the fact that Jamie Smith is currently having to step up to cover for a man you know well in Darren Moore, we hope he recovers from his pneumonia COVID as quickly as possible. I mean, that's a lot of mixed messages in amongst the squad, isn't it? And a lot of people trying to get them going and tweak the way they play or overhaul the way they play.
And I think it's exactly what I've just said around Derby. You know, unconsciously, it does sort of get back to the players, the feel around the club, what's going on in the background, the owners. There needs to be a clear direction and focus of where they're going and what they're doing. You know, to have managers come in and play different styles and different formations, different ethoses, it's hard over 3 or 4 seasons, never mind 1 season. So again, for them to be where they are, I think it's testament to the group of players that they've got, and who will know on the last day of the season. I wouldn't like to call it, to be honest.
Does a squad want different things? Do some players need reminding of the severity of the situation, i.e. this will have a catastrophic effect on this football club and you as players, etc. But others know that that's blinkingly obvious and they need a kind of softer approach. Are a manager's communication skills deeply tested on a week like this in the run-up to a massive game like this?
I think they are, but again, I go back to it. A lot of the managers haven't been there for a long period of time, maybe shirking responsibility, not on purpose, but saying, look, I wasn't privy to the first part of the season and this isn't my responsibility. Some of the players might be out of contract. Some of the players might not want to be at the club. There's so many different things, so many different factors that play a part in that. But at the same time, I go back to it. The clubs that are doing well and have got promotion and are fighting at the top of the league have the opposite. You know, they have a clear direction. They have players that know where they're going. They have players that are fighting for the next level or they want to be successful. And that, for me, is the difference.
In Skybet League One, congratulations to Hull, who are champions. Congratulations to Peterborough with their late snatch of that second automatic place. Blackpool, Sunderland and Lincoln's playoff places confirmed. Portsmouth, Oxford and Charlton will contest the final place. In fact, I'll give you those fixtures right now. Charlton are at home to Hull. Oxford at home to Burton, Portsmouth at home to Accrington. Obviously, from James' point of view, the outstanding fixture this weekend is Doncaster against Peterborough, who are managed by Darren Ferguson, who obviously was with you at Doncaster. I mean, five promotions, I think he started 2007, five promotions in 14 seasons. That's not to be sniffed at, is it? That is a man who knows what he's doing.
Yeah, definitely. He's arguably one of the best managers I've worked with.
Why? Why is he?
Again, I go back to it. Sir Bobby, Sir Kenny Dalglish, Sean O'Driscoll, Eamon for my time at Exeter, and Darren, you know, I just felt like he had that aura about him, you know, very much like his dad in terms of you almost demands respect and very organised, knows what he wants. Not scared to ruffle a few feathers, but at the same time, you know, his management skills are really, really good. I keep in close contact with him now. Always messages me, like the other day about the award, messages me congratulating me, and vice versa. Just a genuinely really, really good guy, and to have five promotions, and you know, to work under him and you know, be able to see how he works every single day. I've never come across a manager who doesn't work as hard as he does.
Commiserations to Rochdale, whose 7-year stay in Skybet League One is over, despite that late rally they had in the season, at Northampton Town, who went down after a single season. How big is that gap between Skybet League Two and Skybet League One?
I think it is quite big, you know, from the bottom end of League One to the top of League Two. You know, it is tough. Obviously, Swindon have gone back down. There's some real good teams in League One, and it's getting more competitive every single season for me. But, you know, with the three that are coming up, it'll be a good challenge for them to test themselves against, again, another sort of good bunch of teams coming down from the Championship.
Yeah, in Skybet League Two. I'll give you the table, actually. Obviously, everybody's played the same amount of games, one game to go. Cheltenham currently top on 79 points, then Cambridge on 77, Bolton on 76, and Morecambe on 75. So Cheltenham already promoted. Two of Cambridge, Bolton, and Morecambe will go up. The other one will go in to the playoffs with three from Newport County, Tranmere Rovers, Forest Green Rovers, Exeter City and Salford City. What are those Cambridge United players thinking, having missed out two weekends in a row, beaten at Stevenage at home when everybody thought they could do it, and then they go up to Harrogate where they lose 5-4, and so suddenly a fortnight has gone past and they have to go into the final game of the season, you know, needing to still get at least a point to get themselves over the line with their superior goal difference?
Again, I think they would have thought that they've been promoted by now, which is always a risk. Again, going back to it, we played Cheltenham on the last day of the season, needed a win to go up. They needed a win to stay up. And we got beat because we again thought we would be promoted. It was easy. So it's about focusing on that one game, that one performance. I know it's hard to, or easy to say, but hard to do, but take the emotion out of it. That's what I would be saying. And no doubt with the quality that they've got, you know, I think team of the season, they've had two people in team of the season, one player of the season as well. So no doubt they've got the quality to win that game or draw that game and get promoted.
Cambridge entertain Grimsby. Cheltenham, who obviously still need to see how it goes in terms of who takes the title there, are at home to Harrogate. Bolton travel to Crawley. Morecambe at home to Bradford. And of those playoff contenders, it's Exeter at home to Barrow. Forest Green travel to Oldham. Salford at home to Leyton Orient. Newport are at Southend and Tranmere at home to Colchester. Southend relegated from the Football League after 101 years, despite picking up a couple of consecutive wins. You've been there. You've dropped out of the Football League as you did with Exeter. I mean, just how lonely a place is that?
Yeah, arguably the loneliest. But again, I go back to it. As a player, you know, Southend have been in and around that for a few seasons. It's not clear where they're going in terms of ownership. I know they've had their ups and downs, but it filters through as a player. You want clarity. You want to understand when you're playing every week that you're aiming and moving in the right direction. It was the same when I was at Exeter. I went into a losing mentality, and they've been flirting or in and around the bottom of the league for three or four seasons. And it was the best thing that ever happened to Exeter in the kindest possible way. You know, they reevaluated, restructured. Julian Tagg took over the club, and, you know, they went from strength to strength, got back into the league, and they're pushing in the right end of the table to try and get into League One again. So, you know, it can be a blessing in disguise depending on what happens next.
You just don't see it at that particular moment when you know you've got a long drive home from Barrow and the world looks a little bit uncertain. Mate, it's been a fantastic chat. We really, really appreciate it. I've got three quick final questions for you. Number one is, what is the first thing you're going to do on Monday morning when you get out of bed and you are no longer a professional footballer? Actually, let's just be clear.
Oh my God, that's just hurt me.
Yeah, I was going to say, but keep it decent when we're talking about this, mate. Seriously, you're going to get up and it's not a temporary lack of structure, it's not a temporary rest, it's a permanent end to your career as a footballer. Have I rammed that home enough? What's the first thing you're going to do? What one thing are you most looking forward to? And it might be something that maybe football has prevented you from doing. Saturday afternoon shopping trips to the to the Metro Centre?
Not a chance. Now I'm looking forward to going skiing. You know, I've never been skiing. As a kid growing up, I always wanted to go snowboarding and go on a skiing holiday with my girlfriend and family. So I can't wait to go there and experience that for the first time.
Okay, and my final question is this, and it's a real goodie. It's going to have you searching. I want your number one piece of advice or thing that you've learned over the course of your career. It can be related to football and to budding footballers, or it can be just a general piece of worldly wisdom. It's up to you how you answer it. So it's the number one thing you've learned or your number one piece of advice.
I think the biggest thing for me in life is believing in yourself. And I know it's quite cliche, but, you know, if you don't believe in yourself, then how can you expect others to believe in you? It's something that I've carried with me from being a young kid. You know, I've had disappointments and setbacks, and people have rejected me from Premier League clubs when I was younger, said I was too small, said I would never make it. But I've always had that underlying self-belief. Not confidence, not arrogance, but self-belief, believing in me as a person. So I think no matter what you do, you know, if you believe in yourself and you want to get there, you ultimately will.
Loved your company. As always, I do. One word, congratulations.
Cheers, Clem. Appreciate it.
That is it for this episode, when our special guest has been Doncaster Rovers' modern-day great and the winner of the Sir Tom Finney Lifetime Achievement Award at this year's EFL Awards, James Coppinger. Good luck to him as he embarks on the next stage of his life. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. Good luck also to everybody fighting for promotion or to avoid relegation this weekend. My name is Mark Clement. Thanks very much for listening. Join us again soon for another episode of
the official EFL podcast.